Marshall and Sagar here. Been waiting a few weeks to say that. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, Sagar. Let's just ask a very basic question. How are you doing? It's been a few weeks since we've seen you.
Yeah, I was in Los Angeles. Got a bunch of conference stuff coming up, so it was kind of a wild experience. LA was fun. For the LA people who are listening out there, interesting city. I was mostly downtown, which kind of sucks. I think everybody could agree with that. To be honest, I was totally shocked by the homeless situation. But as a weather guy, I will say, best weather, bar none. Incredible. Like, truly, you wake up every morning, feels great, wearing sunglasses at 9 a.m., great life. So it's a mixed bag out there. Gas is $6.50 a gallon, which is pretty wild. It was a fun time.
Yeah, Sagar and I are on the East Coast, so we woke up yesterday to 30-degree weather at the start of April, which is not what anyone is looking for. So that's good context on the weather stuff. So, no, cool. So, hey, everyone, this is the discussion style episode that we're going to start doing more. I want to do a quick note. There was a question that we got. We want these to be very interactive. One of the questions was, hey, Marshall, love the content. Where's Sagar? And at a basic level, this past month was me waking up saying, hey, like, I am obsessed with this topic. There's a lot of stuff to do there. So I'm just going to record every single day. And I think something that isn't quite clear, because there's this weird dichotomy between Sagar and my lifestyles. Sagar can only tape on Wednesdays and Fridays, maybe Thursday, if it's like the perfect intersection guest, because I visited you this weekend. You have like an hour long commute. So I just wake up, could hop on Zoom pretty much whenever I want and can record things. So we had to basically make a choice this month. Do we reduce content? Or do we just lean into this and really do this? So what we're doing moving forward is you'll basically make half to two-thirds of the interviews a month, but then we're adding these discussion episodes to the overall thing. Because once again, we're just taping this at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, which is much more amenable and we're not having to shift between people's schedules. Another quick note for folks, during the pandemic, it was amazingly easy to book everyone because everyone, including the biggest guests, were sitting in their offices all day. And I just had the experience of having to book a guest a month out. And that was not fun. That's not what we're looking to basically do here. So yeah, so that's just a quick note how we're doing the programming. Quick note, obviously, if you enjoy this discussion, if you enjoy what we're talking about, be sure to send a tip. So let's just start here, Sagar. What is a story that I or me or any listeners who've been over focused on your game, what have we missed? Like, what's something you've been really focused on?
Yeah, the number one most obvious one is gas. I've been obsessed with gas prices. I just think it's one of those things where as much as the media talks about it, it's still not enough. There was a poll recently came out, NBC News poll earlier this week, where voters said that they care more about inflation by 70% than any single other thing. And even though they disapprove of Biden's handling on Ukraine, what's really dragging him down is inflation. And a huge part of inflation right now is gas. And there's a lot of geopolitics and energy markets and national policy that intersects within gas. What I'm always interested in are the backbone infrastructure parts of the economy, which are not getting a lot of focus because it's not sexy. I mean, just yesterday I did a monologue on China's lockdown policy. This is something I should flag for everybody. This is going to be a real issue. China has a zero COVID policy. Now, that sounds really dumb, but I will kind of stand for the Chinese Communist Party here. Here's part of the issue. They have something like a 40 to 50% full vaccination rate amongst their elderly population.
Can you be precise? What does zero? Why are you saying that sounds dumb? What is
so zero COVID means that you lock down the policy. Zero COVID means that no case of COVID is acceptable to the general population. You can't allow spread. Basically, instead of, you know, leaning on what we've done here in the U.S., emphasis on therapeutics, on vaccines, and on living your life with the disease, they don't have accept that yet. And that's because we have a very, very high vaccination rate, particularly amongst our elderly population. China does not. And in a way, they've actually owned themselves very hard. A lot of old people in China refuse to get the vaccine because they trusted the CCP to make sure that COVID spread would never get out of control. Now, that works until Omicron, because it's highly transmissible, 1,000 more. And now they just had to lock down the entire city of Shanghai. They locked down Shenzhen. I mean, here's the problem too. The full vaccination takes a month in terms of spacing out doses. There's no way that they have a month. So you're about to see mass death in China out there amongst the elderly population, not the general population, the elderly population, which again, it's China. They have hundreds of millions of these folks. And there's actually a lot of reverence for the elderly in Chinese culture. So you can't just, you know, like be like, well, sorry, you know, that's how it goes. And then at the same time, the economic effects of this are huge. I mean, right now we only see Shenzhen and Shanghai cities that are in lockdown. This could soon spread to whole provinces like we saw 2 years ago in Wuhan. The CCP really, really played itself by not vaccinating more of its elderly population. And now with the hit of Omicron, they have nothing they can basically do. It's going to wipe out a significant part of their population, I think.
Yeah, and the thing to add here, and I'm doing a hit on Breaking Points about this today for Wednesday. This is going to affect the supply chain issue.
Yeah, which
is,
that's why it matters for you, exactly.
This is going to really, we're not getting out of the supply chain crisis question. I was telling Chris Mims, who we had on the show back in October, I believe, basically, it seems like we're just going to keep talking about supply chains for the rest of this decade. There's always going to be some big issue. So once again, take a look out for that. No, so getting to our next section, we're going to do a bunch of stuff on Ukraine. Then we're going to wrap with Sagar's favorite topic, of course, the launch of CNN Plus. But let's just start with taking a few audience pushes and responses. So this came in from Thomas on the pod page. So if you want to just send a note in, do that too. Thomas basically said, hey guys, I, you know, love the show. Thank you, Thomas. And, you know, I've been impressed with the analysis. Unfortunately, and this is how you know, but something's about to go.
I was like, where's the but?
There's always a but. Unfortunately, I feel as if a lot of the analysis has shifted into a kind of boring Russia bad, Russia bad, Russia bad frame. Any chance you could bring on analysts who are more skeptical of the Western NATO framing of the Russia's special operation? The realignment is fantastic as it engages with an orthodoxy in a substantive way. That ingenuity, I feel, has been lost in the Ukraine episode. So here's my question for you, Sarah, because I actually was like interested in this idea. What is the unorthodox take about Ukraine that you're willing to take? Because one thing I'll add here is, look, you and I did never supported the no-fly zone. We never supported boots on the ground. I think we're in this semi-awkward position when post-invasion, which once again was never actually supposed to happen, there's not much room for a hot take, this, this, or that. At least that's my perspective. How do you think about it?
I would say maybe what he's getting at, and I've had to push back on this on the show, is the triumphalism here in the West at how badly things are going for the Russians. So I keep quoting Michael Kaufman. He's a respected military analyst at the Center for Naval Analyses here in Washington. He says this, the Russian military is not 12 feet tall, but it's also not 4 feet tall. So this is actually what my whole monologue is about for Thursday's show, which is that part of the problem that we have right now is that there's a lot of triumphalism trying to cast Russia as a third rate army. And in terms of a great power military, yeah, they look like a joke. But that doesn't mean that the joke still doesn't have nuclear weapons and an immense capacity to inflict suffering upon Ukraine, NATO allies, and even the United States, would it ever come to that. So I think maybe what they're getting at is that there is a sense that, like I said, a triumphalism, a dunking on Russia, like a lack of respect for their capacity and capabilities, despite the embarrassing thing that they just did in Ukraine, which is definitely missing from the commentariat. A good example, I was pulling this up while you talked. I don't necessarily agree with this, but this is a good example, is that right now the narrative in the media is that Russia never actually wanted to take Kyiv, but that they were surrounding it and that they're pulling away from it. And thus, you know, their pulling away is like a complete and total embarrassment to them. I think that's probably half true, but there are some people kind of on the dissident left, right space, like whatever you want to say, who are pointing out that it's actually a pretty basic tenet of maneuver warfare, where the Russians had a feint outside of Kyiv, tied up a lot of resources while they were sweeping through and taking Mariupol, establishing a land bridge with the Crimea, and consolidating his forces in the Donbas and Luhansk like they always were going to. And that part of the added benefit was, well, if Kyiv falls, then that's great. But if it doesn't, then okay, whatever. It's not actually a core strategic military objective. In other words, Russia actually probably did accomplish the vast majority of its actual military goals in this campaign leading up to this point. And that's an interesting way of talking about it, right? Which is you're not really hearing about this. Now, I think that this is a bit too cute by half. I think that they did have maximalist goals in terms of wanting to take Kiev and all of that, but they probably weren't as dumb not to have a plan B. And I think that that's where we are right now. So did they lose? I don't know. I mean, in terms of the peace talks, Zelensky is talking about a peace deal, complete neutrality, which is from NATO, which is codified in referendum and in the Constitution. No offensive weapons. They are obviously never going to give up Crimea, Donbass, Luhansk. So they're going to keep all of this territory from a military perspective, not grand strategic, because grand strategic, I think, was a disaster, given the pushback from the West and all about the isolation of Russia and becoming a pariah state. But from a pure like military perspective of what happened on the ground, they kind of accomplished most of what they said they wanted, not the unspoken part, obviously. So maybe that's a way that I could give the middle ground take that I think is missing from a lot of people who are out there.
Yeah, the one thing, and once again, you're articulating a position that you don't quite perfectly hold. So this is less me pushing back on you, pushing back on this narrative. If you want to basically see this argument, check out Michael Brendan Doherty on Twitter, who's basically the person who's articulating this. I would say, A, it's not possible to separate the military from the strategic. So once again, the question should be,
I agree.
So once again, here's the problem with this analysis to your point. A, they already had Crimea. And B, if all Putin wanted was to keep the breakaway republics, all he had to do was move forces in there and not expand beyond there.
Right.
That is really what shocked people. So if all this was just to keep Crimea and keep the eastern parts of Ukraine, you did not need to do all those moves. I think for the folks who are saying that the Kyiv thing was just a misdirection, well, all the paratroopers who got dropped in and slaughtered those first 3 days really should be, from the grave, deeply, deeply pained and skeptical if that argument is true, which is why it just wasn't true. The whole purpose of this military operation was Ukraine would fall in 3 or 4 days. They would be dropped in. You get a new puppet regime, all those different bits. The question one should ask oneself, and this is where we get to the question of is Ukraine winning or is Russia winning, quote unquote? From my perspective, I think Russia is winning, if you define this as they get Crimea and they get the eastern parts of the country and they get Ukraine not in NATO. But here's the other side of that. A, Ukraine was never going to join NATO. Straight up. We've had this debate. We talked about this a million times. There was all this NATO expansion that obviously happened in the 90s and 2000s, which you could argue was ill-advised. That said, post-Crimea in 2014, Ukraine was never joining NATO. So I don't think it's reasonable at all to say, hey, we've now accomplished this objective through this war because they weren't going to join in the first place anyways. Two, next question you should ask yourself at a strategic level is, was upwards of tens of thousands of deaths the destruction of the narrative around your military? Because once again, like you said, the perception going into this was the Russians were 12 feet tall. You may think, and I think it's actually fair to argue, that they're actually 6 feet tall.
I would say seven.
Pretty
tall.
But a lot of people now think it's 2 to 3 feet tall, which means that Putin has lost so much credibility and strength out of this. So once again, I think when people, and here's what I'll say to add here, and I think this listener is probably spending a lot of time on Twitter, and I understand where they're coming from. There are a lot of people on Twitter who are pro-Ukraine in the way that I am pro-Ukraine that are just way too credulous. So these are the people who are sharing Ghost of Kyiv memes and say, holy crap, the Russian Air Force just did happen on this. It's just going to be done. And holy crap, only 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers are dying and 15,000 Russians are dying. It's a win. That is ridiculous. That isn't serious. You should separate the way normie people are interacting with these facts from how the actual analysts are basically describing it. What I would basically say is the place where I'll end on this one is, A, Russia's military is underestimated in the public narrative right now, to your point, Sagar. But B, the reason why I think Ukraine is going to come out ahead, quote unquote, is that Russia as a long, and not just Ukraine, but even just the even the West and NATO, you now have like all these Western countries which are now spending far more money mm-hmm. On their defense budgets. There's like clear unanimity around no more expansion. There's almost no world where Putin is going to be able to foment insurrection in Latvia or any of the Baltic countries in a way that he could have Crimea. I think that's a total strategic loss. So for the next subject, someone asked us, Robert B. asked us to talk about this. Brett Stevens had a good op-ed in the Times this morning said, what if Putin did not miscalculate? And the idea basically is, he actually basically articulated what you just articulated, Sagar, which is, hey, like people are saying that he's made this huge strategic error, all these problems have basically happened. But at a core level, the things that he could reasonably get, he's going to get those things. Mm-hmm. So just can you react to that argument?
Yeah, I think it's a fine one. It's just hard because, like you said, we're pulling between these two massive extremes where people say Russia's actually winning and Russia is nothing. It's like, look, from the beginning, all I've said was it's complicated. It's very complicated. Yeah, grand strategically, I thought it was a disaster. I mean, you remember this, the day of the invasion, I was like, here's what's going to happen. NATO is going to expand its eastern flank. U.S. defense budget's going to go up. I was like, there's going to be more United NATO than ever before. Putin will have accomplished the goal of pushing Germany and the UK and France in order to spend more than 2% of their spending GDP on national defense, something that the US has been trying to get them to do for 15 years. Literally all of those things have already happened, all of them within the span of a month. That actually, if I'm Russia, I'm a lot less safe now, actually, if I consider my core security interests. So on the one hand, that's it. On the other hand, yeah, like he's going to get his territory. I don't know. I mean, it's just hard to separate.
Is it worth it? I don't understand.
No, I don't think so.
This is the big problem.
It's a face-saving
here.
Maneuver for sure. But it's, I mean, look, if you're Russia, if you're Putin, well, even more important, if you're the Russian people, like you just got nuked. I mean, financially, no more McDonald's, no more Coca-Cola. Like you lost all of your, look, you can make fun of me for that, but you can go and you can look at the literal guy in Russia who chained himself to a McDonald's because he liked it so much. Shout out to him, by the way. And
pour one out for the homie.
Yeah, I feel bad. I feel very bad for them. I mean, also in terms of, you know, all the conductor cancellation nonsense, that obviously is dying down, but try being openly Russian, you know, probably at a UK university or like, I mean, there's a lot of Russians out there who are in math programs and hard sciences all across the US in terms of PhD programs, stuff like they're going to suffer for this for a long time. Visas for the rest of the world, obviously getting cut off from SWIFT. The financial ramifications, I don't think it was worth it whatsoever. And I don't see any of that coming back either.
And this is the key response to the question of did Putin miscalculate? Putin miscalculated in the sense that no one looks at what just happened the past month and is going to say that Putin is a grand strategic genius mm-hmm. in the context moving forward. So does he look good from 2014 to 2020? Yes, 100%. But, and once again, you know this take, I just really do like there's obviously the over-exaggeration insanity around like Putin's on steroids. So his brain is melted, but COVID, I genuinely think it's true that COVID lockdown. And once again, we see these in the pictures with him with these giant tables, the hyper paranoia, which is very clearly out there, that effectively wrecked his ability to be a grand strategist and calculate precisely. Because once again, every single thing that he listed as a problem going into this invasion has been heightened. Now more Europeans and Westerners in general think of Russia as a threat than they did before. And once again, we're not even talking about the China aspect here. China kind of had their back, kind of didn't have their back. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the only thing that's going to happen here is that Russia, we talked about this with yesterday's episode around populations, but Russia is now a declining civilizational power if it has to attach itself to China as its junior partner, which is, once again, not what Putin wanted, is not what you want to go down in history for doing. So for the next section, I want to respond to something on YouTube. I wanted to, like to get your take on this. You actually did a monologue around this. Hey, Marshall, great episode. Question I have is, Joe Biden recently remarked that Putin should be out of power. The thing is, every single person I've talked to has agreed, and don't you and Sagar. I find it funny that he's completely in step with your average American and he's getting chastised for agreeing. What's going on there, right? This is, I actually really like the way the person phrased the question, because to be clear, if you ask me, do you want Vladimir Putin in power? I would say no, I don't want Putin to be in power. So much of this conflict is about his bad decisions. But there's a complicated wrinkle that I'd love you to actually get in to when you separate that personal analysis from a president giving an address at a NATO conference.
It's, yeah, that's why I find that take so frustrating. Those people, you sound like Trump defenders to me, where they're like, he's just saying what it is. He's just telling it like it is. It's like, yeah, but he's the president. Like, for example, one of the things I hated most about what Biden said is he goes, I was not articulating a change in U.S. policy. I was just, expressing my moral outrage. No, dude, it's a well-established norm that the words of a president matter. You said that on the campaign trail. You said that in your announcement for running for president based upon what Trump said at Charlottesville. It's also a well-established norm that the words of the president are the policy of the United States, because we invest in you immense power because of your democratic election, not based upon whatever your junior aides or whatever the State Department says. It's what you say that matters. So yeah, and I've said this on the show. Do I think Putin should be out of power? Yeah, I'm a guy on YouTube. I'm a commentator. I can say whatever I want. Yeah, that's literally my job. I'm a take-haver. I'm a pundit. It's very different if I was the literal president of the United States. For example, Rwanda was a good one. Remember during Rwanda, I think it was Susan Rice torturing herself not to say the word genocide.
So this is 1994, the Rwandan genocide.
1994, the Rwandan genocide. Obviously, if I was on TV, I would have been like, this is a genocide. But when you're at the State Department and you say the word genocide, well, that kicks in the Geneva Convention and the Hague and then all these tripwires and U.S. foreign policy. So in other words, when they say it, it's different than whenever we say it. Same when Biden calls Putin a war criminal. This one pissed me off, too. Do I think Putin is a war criminal? Yeah. Guess what, though? War criminal means something. You have to present evidence to The Hague as a president of the United States, speaking off the cuff to a reporter's shouted out question and making a declaration of U.S. policy, which then has to be backed up by the State Department. That's bad. And it's funny because I had to deal with this all during the Trump era. All the Trumpers were like, oh, yeah, well, he's just...
What did Trump do? What's an example?
We say this stuff all the time. Fire and fury like the world has ever seen before. Everyone's like, that's just how he talks. I'm like, yeah, but these are nukes. And he has his finger on the button. That's actually a real problem. Or whatever he would say, make declarations about NATO, for example. He'd be like, oh, I'm just talking. It's like, no. You're the president. Like, you, the policy of the United States is invested within you. And his supporters would back him up. So telling it like it is fine. On the campaign trail, it's not fine when it comes to foreign affairs, declarations of U.S. policy. Look, I actually went back and checked. Not one U.S. president during the entire Cold War ever called for regime change in Russia. Not one. During the Soviet Union, even at the height of rollback and the evil empire, there was still not a declaration of regime change in the Soviet Union. Why? Because the same nuclear doctrine existed in the Soviet Union that exists in Putin's Russia today, which is that a threat to the regime itself is enough for a first strike under their nuclear doctrine. So this is part of what's annoying, too. I just feel like a lot of people seem to think I'm some sort of catastrophist whenever it comes to these things. It's not that I'm trying to play things up. I'm saying that the risk of nuclear exchange, let's say it's 2-5%. That's really high. I mean, doesn't it scare you, Marshall, when you start to see talks about small tactical nukes in Ukraine? I was like, what is this, 1955? The Suez Canal and Dien Bien Phu? Like, we have established norms on this stuff. And now it's like everything is up for grabs. And it's like, as we all learned, I got a bunch of Kennedy books behind me. Go read about the history of the 13 days and the Cuban Missile Crisis. John F. Kennedy literally was having a normal ass day where he was about to go to a campaign fundraiser, woke up, and 3 days later, the world was on the brink of nuclear war. That's how fast it can happen. And the reason that we have all these well-established norms and back channels of deconfliction and the way the president talks and all this around nuclear powers is specifically in order to mitigate the risk of even a slight increase of a nuclear exchange and miscalculation.
You know, it's funny. There are a couple different Sagar and jetties that folks are going to start getting acquainted more, especially when you do this type of format. And this version of Sagar and Jetty is Norm's Defender Sagar, yeah, which I don't think a lot of people, I think if people watch certain especially monologues, you, they wouldn't, because it's funny, like, you know, there's a cringe never Trumper podcast called Words Matter. Yeah. But guess what? That's actually kind of what you're saying. So it's just actually fun. And once again, this is why you're actually not a hypocrite, because words actually do matter. And I think this is I want to go back to the first point around, like, we need to find more unorthodox takes. I definitely think it's important for you and I, because we're kind of like insidery in the sense mm-hmm. that, like, I work at a think tank, used to be a White House correspondent, it's important that we find ways to needle at conventional wisdom, but actually sometimes things just aren't sexy. Yeah. And the very unsexy thing that you're saying is, hey, actually presidents, either Republican, Democrat, independent, forward party, pick your poison, should not just pop off and cannot just talk that way. And once again, if Joe Biden, you know, I did a lot of Biden standing this month, I'll actually say the actual critique of him. And by the way, this critique has nothing to do with his age, because this has always been his problem.
Who he is.
He can just literally not police his mouth. He can just not, you know, it's really funny. He genuinely needs to, if think of your Ron Burgundy Anchorman reference, you know, Ron mm-hmm. Burgundy will always just only, he'll read the prompter. Biden, just for whatever reason, has no ability to just read the prompter and to just not say anything. And it's been a perpetual issue for him. And once again, this was supposed to be his argument against Trump. You know, for an example of just Trump popping off in ways that weren't okay. Remember at the start of his presidency, when he took the call from the leader of Taiwan, didn't even think about it. And once again, there's an argument for, you know, once again, we're very pro-Taiwan here, but that was a contravention of decades mm-hmm. of policy that provoked a huge incident with the Chinese. So you really just, with both these presidents, and once again, I think this is also like an age-related dynamic here. There is just a very clear lack of willingness to change their behavior when it's just not necessary. Because like you said, on the campaign trail, this is a useful tactic, and I'm not going to be, you know, shivering in my britches or falling on my fainting couch when someone's aggressive on the campaign trail. But there has to be a line when it comes to anything involving nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. That includes Taiwan. That includes Ukraine. So for the next topic, and I want to actually get to this because it brings to mind the history bit that you and I really enjoy. I've been very frustrated by a lot of the discourse around the U.S. needs to settle this and the U.S. needs to promote peace in Ukraine. Because oftentimes during this conversation, let me just make clear what I'm referring / subtweeting to. So there's just been this point that, look, there's all this escalation. There's been all this danger. The U.S. is obviously engaged in the conflict. Putin is threatening the West, all these different bits. People rightfully say, look, Ukraine, no matter what, is not worth the world blowing up. And I mm-hmm. definitely agree with that. And forget even the world blowing up. It's not worth a full-scale conventional war between the U.S. and Russia. Let's just pretend that there were no nukes. World War III, even without nukes, really would not bad. Be pre-nuclear World War II killed, you know, 50 million people. 100% not worth it in either case. So what people then say is, why can't Biden do what Henry Kissinger did? I know people don't like Kissinger here, but what Henry Kissinger did during the Yom Kippur War between Israel and the Arab states in the 1970s, which is, why can't the U.S. fly in there as the great, as the superpower, and just proclaim terms and get Zelensky to back down? What frustrates me is just what should be very clear to everyone right now is that, A, we live in a multipolar world, and what the result of a multipolar world is, individual countries have much more leeway over what they could do. Sure, the U.S. was having trouble in the 1970s. Sure, Vietnam was winding down towards a loss. There was gas prices, there was inflation, but the U.S. was still the second superpower. Israel, the Arab states, all these countries were still below the U.S. in power. In this case here, we really are in a situation where if Zelensky and the Ukrainian people, which, by the way, they actually support Zelensky on this, if the Ukrainians do not want to give up Crimea, there's basically nothing that we can do about that. And this actually is an awkward conflict where this really is between the Russians and the Ukrainians. Now, we can put pressure, we could have input, but the only thing that I could really think that would maybe shift the Ukrainians was the U.S. just saying, all right, it's over. We are cutting off all support. But even in that case, do you know who wouldn't cut off support? the rest of Europe. So even in this really unique case, the US is not like the leader of this coalition, like the Poles. There is nothing the US could say that would make the Poles stop sending weapons to Ukraine. There's nothing the Swedes or the Finns could do that make basically stop there. So there's this weird dynamic where I don't think people who want the US to intervene and stop the conflict from escalating, I don't think they understand how little, and this has nothing to do with Biden, nothing to do with Trump, they have little understanding of what it means to try to do these intervening roles in a multipolar world. I mean, what's your take?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I actually been making the same point, especially the people who are like, Ukraine should just give up. I'm like, okay, like you can tell them that, you know, that's up to them. It's not up to us.
Look, Sagar, it's 1940, Churchill, right. You got to give up. It's crazy. France just lost. Why are you still fighting?
Right. My only pushback on this idea is the one way where this critique does apply is, hey, Biden, don't talk about regime change. It's like, hey, while you're declaring Putin a butcher, a war criminal, and calling for regime change, Zelensky in Russian, see, this is always a funny part. Zelensky, there's two Zelenskys. There's Zelensky in Israel and US calling for NATO no fly zone and weapons. And then there's Russian Zelensky. And his most recent interview with the Russian journalist, he's like, oh yeah, we'll give up neutrality. We could talk about Crimea in 15 years, you know, all this stuff. That part doesn't get as much play here in the West. It's very clear to me that Zelensky himself is trying to play both sides and is very much angling and opening the door to peace, especially on the Russian front. And I think we should support that. Look, the guy who has we've given the guy more weapons under the sun than anything he could ever have. We've fulfilled his requests up to the point of the no-fly zone, which obviously should reject. But then we should empower him on that side. And what I would just say, my critique of the Biden people is by calling Putin and declaring him officially a war criminal by the U.S. State Department, and by Biden calling for regime change and then doubling down on that in his press conference, that's where you're actually not helping the peace process. There is literally right now a peace process going on in Turkey, and Turkey's actually doing a pretty good job of facilitating this. You know, they have an interesting relationship with the Russians too. Also, they're in NATO, so they're a good bridge. And also, part of the floated thing, and this is why our role matters, is that any future peace deal per Ukraine would have to also have buy-in from the U.S. and NATO in terms of a quote limited security guarantee. I don't know what that looks like. Nukes, I have no idea. That's probably going to be the hardest thing in order to hammer out. And I suspect that's where the Russian red line is. But the point is okay, if Zelensky wants to talk, and look, Crimea is freaking gone anyway. And look, the DNR and LNR, they've been in civil war for like 8 years. I'm not saying it's just, but like, look, if it were me, give it up.
If Putin wants it, Putin keeps it.
Yeah, he's going to keep it. And you know, look, whatever. More what I'm saying is that the U.S. should empower both sides of that. And that's where I get very annoyed with Biden, which is by declaring a policy. Dude, remember this. Macron was like, hey, he needs to stop. Macron subtweeted Biden in French. He didn't say it in English, but he gave an interview to France 24 where he said people need to stop doing. He said people need to stop calling him a butcher. He's like, this is not the time for escalation. And Macron, I think, is the best diplomat on the continent right now. He's doing a very good job.
Yeah, and I just want to speak on a quick Zelensky point. So look, I'm very pro Zelensky. I really like his leadership post invasion. The one thing though I will harp on is the huge miscalculation on the no-fly zone.
Yeah, and Israel. You should talk on that too.
You take Israel. I'll do no-fly zone. So, and it's related, but like you give this perspective there. So look, I get why Zelensky's job is to push. It's like you said, he's actually doing two things. He's speaking to Russia. Three things. He speaks to the Russians. He speaks to the Ukrainians. He speaks to the West. Those are the three balls he has to juggle, which is a very difficult set of balls to juggle. So when he's pushing on the West, his job is to ask. You and I were talking about this in a different context yesterday. Like, how many times should one ask before one just accepts a no? Mm-hmm. So this conflict happens after, because remember, once again, like, you know, I'm the U.S. intelligence shill here, so I'll talk about this. U.S. intel got the invasion right. They proclaimed that the Kyiv was going to fall in 3 to 5 days, so that part was wrong. So on day six, everyone, you, me, serious, bigger people, were like, holy crap, this is not going the way we thought this was going. Kyiv is going to exist. Zelensky survived a couple of assassination attempts. Like, actually, Ukraine, not fully intact, but Ukraine may actually come out of this from a survival perspective. So in that environment where everyone's totally discombobulated, it is Zelensky's job to ask, to say, hey, you're giving me weapons. I also want a no-fly zone. Ghost of Kyiv narrative's going on. The West is excited. I get it. Make that ask. Second time he makes the ask, by the 15th time he was making that ask, he was severely, really, really, really testing. And this is, once again, his problem. I do not think he has an accurate political read of the United States and actually a lot of the broader West. So directionally, look, we're sending billions of dollars in aid to Ukraine, and I completely support that policy. But there's a very clear line around risking shooting down a plane. And when he wouldn't recognize that line and felt the need to say things like, this is abetting a Holocaust, this is semi-cowardly, that was a disaster. Because I did this episode of Dr. Robert Farley last week. The issue for Ukraine right now is not Russia's air force. No fly zone isn't. So, I don't know if you know this, but as Farley pointed out, Russia could launch cruise missiles within Russia's territory. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the damage that the Russian air force is actually doing doesn't even have to involve, like, this isn't World War II where you have to fly your B-17 and imprecisely drop bombs. Like, he's like, look, if the Tu-95 Bears and the Tu-160s want to loiter in Belarus and Russia and launch cruise missile strikes, they could do that. And even under this no-fly zone, there's nothing you could actually do about it. So the no-fly zone isn't even actually the problem. The problem, I was like, wait, that's so obvious when you put it that way. The problem is the artillery. The problem are the tanks. And the problem would be, once again, Russia's ability to fly within Ukraine. But that could be accomplished by Stinger missiles and defensive missile systems, which Putin has made clear is not a red line for him. So what he should have said was, West, I understand you do not want to have your pilots, there's something directly accurate there. You don't want to have your pilots risk a shoot down. So here's what I need from you. Help me close the skies. Help me get more Stinger missiles. Help me get defensive missile systems, which, as Putin has made clear by his actions, are not a red line that could provoke escalation. That's what he needed to do. And his inability just to, and I think he's finally gotten there, but it took him 15 tries to get there, and that wasted a lot of time. What's the Israel take?
Oh, well, the Israel one, I thought also was significant disaster. And also, as a Jew, I think you should know better and at least know the politics of Israel, which is that he brought up the Holocaust and compared it to what was happening in Ukraine. And I think
when he was addressing the Knesset, right?
When he was addressing the Israeli Knesset, and it's like, dude, there's actually a lot. Number one, there's a lot of Russian Jews. Everybody seems to forget that in Israel, like one out of every eight Israelis is Russian and came in the post-Soviet Union. I'm not saying they love Putin, but they ain't pro-Ukraine either. Okay. And then there's also a lot of Ukrainian Jews who survived the Holocaust.
Quick thing, Sagar. I'm adopted. Everyone knows this, but people should ask themselves, why is the Kozlov family in America and not Ukraine right now? There's a complicated history here.
And look, I know, you know, not to play into like propaganda or whatever, but like neo-Nazis in Ukraine is like a real thing. And kind of a problem. I'm not saying it's the whole population, it's a very minor part, but it is an issue. And all of what I'm saying is that some Ukrainian Jews don't feel so good about Ukraine, especially in Israel. And then the number one thing in Israel is you pretty much never make reference to the Holocaust ever. And so he in America also did this, comparing what happened to them, to 9/11, to Pearl Harbor, and to many, you know, terrible events in our history. Huge miscalculation in terms of asking for the no-fly zone. But it crosses a whole other line whenever you do that before the Israeli Knesset. And here's how you knew. He got actual statements coming out from Knesset members attacking him after he attacked, saying nothing is comparable to the Holocaust. This was insulting. This is ridiculous. I mean, to have that happen after you give your speech, that's a huge disaster. Here's the other thing too. Israel was your best hope, man. Israel has a great racial relationship with Putin. Like I said, there's a big Russian population and they have a good relationship with Ukraine, and Zelensky's already a Jew. They were taking in a lot of Jewish refugees and stuff from Ukraine. Like, Israel was poised to be up there with Turkey in terms of diplomatic relations between the two countries. And he severely pissed them off when he did that. I thought it was a massive mistake. And once again, I think he's high on his own supply. I mean, he's reading too much like New York Times coverage and, you know, watching Amy Schumer or whatever at the Oscars trying to get him to speak there. And I don't think he understands this country that well. I'll give Churchill credit for something. Got to poke on Churchill's back here somewhere. He actually understood America because his mom was American. He actually understood. He was like, the Senate's not going to vote for us. All of his lend-lease lobbying was happened behind the scenes. He did ask, but he was very strategic around how exactly he would press Roosevelt and understood the actual domestic conditions within the U.S. And that's why he celebrated when Pearl Harbor happened, because he's like, thank God, now they have no reason not to come into this war with us. But with all of the attacks going on in the East, Churchill, I think maybe because he was half American, I don't really know why, but he at least, and he actually had been here a decent amount before he was president or a prime minister. He actually understood this country and the strain of isolationism and the varying centers of power. And he was very, very key in not trying to fulfill the complaints and the warnings, accurate ones, that he wanted to bring them into the war. So I think Zelensky, you know, everybody likes to compare him to Churchill. He should learn a little bit more about Churchill. And Churchill was very, very skillful in how he got the United States slowly towards, especially the public and the Senate and all of that, towards actually being able to ship arms in the Battle of Atlantic and all of that to the war.
Yeah, no, that's very, very, very well said. I know, Sagar, you're not a huge fan of Darkest Hour, but
no, I'm not.
First part of the movie.
Inaccurate representation.
To get Barbie the direction that you're speaking of, though, like in the first part of the movie, it's on Netflix right now, people to watch. There's this critical scene where the France is falling. Britain looks just as doomed as Ukraine looked basically 2 or 3 weeks ago. And Winston Churchill is on the phone with FDR and he's asking for war planes. He's asking for destroyers. And it's a funny scene because it's actually what it is. Like, you know, we're not going to F with the accents here, but he's just sort of like, you know, could I get, you know, the planes? And Churchill's like, FDR's like, well, it's can't do it. That is the ability to balance those two things and then to quote unquote, make it work and be, and have ingenuity. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get the planes, but then you come up with Dunkirk, right? Like with the evacuation with sacrificing the British soldiers at Calais. Like that is actually, you need to be able to improvise. And after this is good. We're actually getting to what I think our central critique was. After the second or third ask failed, he basically failed to improvise a better response to basically roll with those punches. Because when I saw this happening on Twitter, and I think Twitter does matter in these contexts. It was after these asks that you first started to see people kind of be like, oh, I don't really know about this. So that's an important note. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're getting to the home stretch here. So I want to take a couple of things here. So number one, Sagar, I did an episode yesterday on population, and a listener wanted to get this question. I did the episode, so I asked this question to you. The question was, wait a second, like we're talking about how. Actually, I'll just specifically get that question so that we don't have to. Make it up. This is what I like about this formula. Basically, here's the idea. So this is from Cameron F. The main point of wanting population growth is essentially have enough people working. We're also hearing conversations about how technological advances could automate out thousands of jobs. This episode was about this idea that like Russia is a declining power because of population. What does this mean? So his point is, can't automation handle the fact the populations are declining, especially in the West? Like you think about this issue a lot, even in the domestic sense, like what's your response to that idea?
Can automation handle population growth? No. I don't know. It almost seems like a ridiculous question to me because.
In the sense that like it requires, here's the bit. The point is in a world where, and actually this is true, like there are less factory work, even when a factory is in Detroit, there are less people on the yard. Mm-hmm. So if there are less people that you need on the yard, it's okay if your population, actually factory, this is good. Factories, productivity is higher and factories are more efficient. Therefore, you don't have to maintain the same level of population to maintain your economy under this argument is a way of summing it up.
Yeah, but that's a ridiculous supposition because that's like articulating, okay, look, nobody out there is advocating for the birth rates of 1600 where you need farms.
We should, don't make that
okay,
claim.
Fine.
We know some out there. We know weird people.
Most people out there do not want to have 9 kids in order to have a farm and have familial wealth, retirement, etc. They do want to have 2.2 kids. They're having 1.6 to 1.9. So what's the problem? So once again, Americans, most people want to have a replacement level fertility rate. We don't have one. There's all sorts of questions as to why. And I actually think that separating out the economic part of this is like, people don't want that. People don't want to have only one kid. That's not natural. It's never been in the history of humans. I think we're paring down to 2 or 3. What's the national average? Like 2, I think. The paring it down is already like causing some interesting imbalances and changes in family units and all of that. But I would just say, take economics out of it completely. And this is one of those things where biology and human nature matters more than anything. And one thing I've learned is, yeah, automation might, I used to actually be a catastrophist about automation. I'm just really not anymore. I'm just, and this is really infuriating to a lot of people out there. I think we'll figure it out. I just do. Like, I really do. Everybody said that about
truckers.
Everybody said that, not even truckers. I'm talking about hundreds of years ago. You know, everybody said, oh, the cotton gin or whatever. It's like, okay, yeah. Actually, the cotton gin ended up increasing slavery, right? Because it increased demand, created a whole, it's a bad example, exactly. But in terms
of jobs, economically accurate, right? Not by economic, the example.
What's accurate here is that by removing, you know, that, you actually unlocked an entire new market and all this new potential, ended up needing even more human capital in order to supply it. Gross way to talk about it, but that's actually true. I'm just saying, in terms of many of these innovations, they've unlocked all sorts of new areas, and who the hell knows what people will work in and will do in the future. That doesn't mean that I don't think that we should guarantee that those new jobs are not, you know, subservient to a billionaire class. I would say that's the biggest danger, but the fact that they won't exist, period. I just don't believe that. It's like a Jurassic Park thing. Life finds a way.
We've got 10 minutes here to close out the hour. So I want to do three quick things. So one, I did a good episode of Dr. Sean McFate on Monday, and the topic was basically like America. His basic point was America's leadership class fails to identify strategic goals in the way that if you're George Kennan in the 40s, you identify containment. That's a strategic goal. He was like, if you talk to most members left, right, and center, they could not articulate a strategic goal for the United States. So I'm just curious, dude, like a month into this, how would you articulate your assessment of what America's strategic goal should be moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't changed much from the very beginning. I think, frankly, from the beginning, I thought, once again, the pull of the old world. The old world is fine. Yes, there's a lot of norms. There's a lot of cultural ties, but that's not where our future is. And it has been evident for that for almost 15 years. I think we should support the Europeans in what they're doing. But I think the Europeans should be the ultimate guarantors of security on the continent, and we can back them up. But a lot is happening right now in Asia. The entire world is completely changing. The future of globalization is India, China. Our trade relationships with those people and in the region matter 10 times more than whatever is going on in Ukraine and Russia. And there's been a subservience currently to the Russia conflict to be even sacrifice relations with some of those countries, which I think is a complete disaster. So
you're referencing India, obviously.
Yeah, India specifically.
I've got an episode coming out on
this. But even,
you
know,
so, yeah.
Taking your eye off of China is insane. I mean, I cannot believe that we're not talking more about China's COVID zero policy. This is going to affect all price, sometimes in good ways, actually, because Chinese demand is about to go down from lockdowns. Oil futures are down like 7%. So congratulations, everyone. That's at least one good thing. But things are about to get real screwy in terms of all the stuff that's around us. And I just think that a lot of the old world obsession and history and knowledge. And look, I like Europe. It's a nice place. You know, it's fun to go and there's a lot of history, but that's not the future. And it hasn't been for a long time. So I don't know. I just feel like we're exactly stuck in the same thing. And even the same old paradigms, you know, right now, Iran deal or no Iran deal. It's like, oh my God, like, didn't we settle this question? Like when are we going to Saudi or not Saudi, you know? And the Saudis are slapping us in the face, embarrassing us, you know, on the world stage. Like, we have no innovative thinking in terms of what we're doing. And I know a lot of people here may not like Henry Kissinger, but What Kissinger and Nixon did is inherit a chaotic world and forge a new one, but with incredibly creative and strategic thinking. I don't see any of that.
And you're referencing opening up to China.
Not just the opening up of China. I mean, even the detente, the wrapping up the coal of the Vietnam War, peace with honor. Opening up of China is just like the most
clear
example. But shuttle diplomacy, I mean, so much of what they did is they changed the world forever, for a long time. And we don't have any of that type of thinking going on right now. I would say that's probably what bothers me the most.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add to what you're saying is there's an opportunity. So this is what I'd say. There's an opportunity here because, once again, after 4 years of Trump and now the Ukraine conflict, the Europeans are actually spending on defense again. This is why Putin did miscalculate. Mm-hmm. This is why I do think the quote unquote West, no matter what happens, is going to come out ahead from a strategic perspective, not even military on the ground. Europe now has the mental state to, in the next 10 years, next 5 years, assume primary defense responsibility in a way that just wasn't true a decade ago. The Europeans now think the Russian threat, because it always was a threat, but they now know that the Russian threat is real. Even the Germans have indicated that moving forward, no matter how this conflict ends, dependence on Russian energy could not be the status quo. That mental shift happened. So I want the pivot to Asia to happen. But there is this 1 to 3 year period coming out of this, and this is what Biden's strategic objective needs to be, where the Europeans are going to need help and handholding getting there. So I think it's very clear that we say, look, Asia is the future. We're happy that you've shifted mentalities. What do we need to do in this 3 year period to get you on your feet? Because you can't just, it's like with a kid, you can't just say, all right, you're 18, Sagar, go out on your, no, like you have to transition out.
Sure.
And I think our strategic objective should be, we pivot to Asia, but we don't do it chaotically. And we do it with a specific, like, here's our goal in X, Y, and Z terms.
Europeans get upset when I talk this way, but here's my problem. We're on 90-10 in terms of our focus. Do they really think that that's what it should be? That's insane. It should be more like 30-70, you know? So I'm not saying you abandon them. Yeah, sure.
Rebalancing.
We can help them. But people are nothing in terms of GDP, in terms of our future. Yeah, we speak the same language. That's nice. You don't produce anything. You have these massive welfare states. You know, you have these decades of hundreds, centuries long conflicts and bullshit that we constantly have to get mired into. Like, in the way that when John F. Kennedy wrote Why England Slept, which is right behind me, you are not the center of the world and haven't been for 70 years. It's just, that's what frustrates me the most. Maybe I'm Indian and look, I'm biased, but I'm just saying, like, I can read a freaking chart and I can say, like, okay, where's the future of the global population and of our interests going to be? And ask yourself, how much discussion in this country was there over shaming India over the ruble oil transaction? How much even is there in terms of what's going on in the South China Sea? Also, I don't know if you saw this, Marshall. North Korea just tested an ICBM for the first time since 2017. These problems did not go away. These are all still real, and we should dedicate way more resources to figuring it out than we currently have. Our North Korea policy is frozen. I don't know if people noticed this. I did. South Korea just elected a very hawkish new president. There is a whole interesting new possibilities in terms of what can happen out on the Korean Peninsula in terms of trying to forge a peace. Biden has had no update to the Obama policy. So that basically means that outside of the blip in Trump, that we've had the same Korea policy for almost 25 years. That's insane. That makes no sense. Same in terms of India. We're talking about India as if it's a non-nuclear power that isn't increasing its GDP in a massive rate and is obviously the only way to balance against China, and also is not a Western country, which will have to be dealt with in a very specific and different set of diplomacy that we are used to in terms of engaging with the rest of the English-speaking worlds. So I don't know. The only time I was excited, I think during the last 6 years, in terms of like what I would like to see, was that submarine deal with the Anglosphere, where the Brits and the US and the Australians were like, no, we all speak the same language. We are the Anglosphere. This fuck NATO, you know, like NATO's fine. France, you're fine. But at the end of the day, like, we're the only ones that we can actually count on. And we're all in this together. That is exactly the type of stuff that I would like to see. and so the future is Asia. Yeah.
So two last quick things. So Sagar, you know, I did the episode of Fred Logavall yesterday on JFK, and it's kind of like a random episode. And you just brought up why I'm going to slap. So I want to give a quick preview to people, like, why are you and I obsessed with 1930s JFK? Because people talk about JFK in the sense of like the 1960s. Like, why do you have a copy of Why England? So it's very close to original copy. Like, why is this like a story that we captivated the two of us?
It's not a first edition, first printing. Ooh. Unfortunately, those go for like 10 grand. It is a first edition, sixth printing, but it was actually printed in 1940. So that's why it has the cool original cover. It's not one of the reprints that JFK had whenever he ran for president. I bought it because JFK is a genius in a way that a lot of people don't really understand. If you go and you read his book, at the age of 22, he was making observations about the world and the coming geopolitical order that defied both his own parents and also some of the leading foreign policy thinkers in the United States. And actually, his explanation for why Britain ultimately had to choose appeasement as its policy is one that it took decades of foreign policy analysts to eventually come to the exact same conclusion. And he came up with it as a senior thesis in a year. I just think he's an incredibly impressive individual at that time in his life, like a real policy entrepreneur, so to speak, in terms of analyzing something. I can't find the tweet, but I actually tweeted this because I learned it from his book, that at Potsdam, there were three successive US presidents, all in the same area at the same time. Harry S. Truman, President of the United States. Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander. John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 28-year-old journalist for Hertz Newspapers.
So this, like, is a 1945. That's crazy. Like, after the
1945 war in Potsdam, Stalin, everybody's there reforming the world. So you have these two great titans. Everybody knows who they are, Truman and Eisenhower, and this nobody 28-year-old journalist who's sitting there too, who's going to succeed Dwight D. Eisenhower as the president of the United States. How did that happen? This is an extraordinary event. He's the youngest president in American history. And for all of the talk of, Joe P. Kennedy's money, look, I'm not saying it didn't help. It obviously did dramatically, but it couldn't just be anybody. And it was like the stars really aligned. And I just find him a very impressive thinker in his time. What I respect are people who are able to have truly original ideas in their time when it's really not easy. It's not popular. I wish I had that skill. But, you know, I can at least recognize it in others.
Yeah, no. And that was actually because I wanted to find the articulation of like why we are doing this episode, because basically the book. So Fred Logavall is a professor at Harvard. He won a Pulitzer Prize for a book, Embers of War, about the French of Vietnam. And his latest book is JFK Volume 1. It's about growing up in the American century, 1917 to 1956. And it's actually a book that as soon as the Ukraine crisis started, Sagar and I actually like went back and read. Because what is so useful about the book, and I want this book to basically, and the idea of this episode to really center people. So many people have written in saying, hey, I don't really know what to do. I don't really know what to think. I'm not like an expert. As Sagar said, JFK, yes, he's the son of the ambassador to Great Britain. He's a multimillionaire, like as this is all happening. But once again, this is before PT 109. This is before he's elected anything. He's just a 22. And look, as Fred points out during the episode, he has access to diplomatic cables across Europe because his father is ambassador. Once again, there are lots of rich kids whose fathers were ambassadors. You know, it's not as if JFK's older brother did this. And that's something we get into. But the point here basically is I want people to think of Why England Slept and then this book as, hey, just because you're in your 20s, just because you're young, doesn't mean that you cannot use periods like this to develop like your own perspective and come up with, Sagar says so eloquently, something original to say. So, okay, here's the, so that's a quick preview of the episode that we'll close out this series next week. But no, here's the actual thing we're going to end with, Sagar. We're going to slightly start pivoting out to news. 1 minute, 2 minutes, take whatever time you want to do. CNN Plus came out this week. I want you to give your most breaking pointiest, dunkiest critique, but then in all seriousness, like you're actually a very successful media entrepreneur. As many people say, like whether or not they like the programming that they're doing, I'm a little skeptical of Jake Tapper's book club as like the thing that people want to tune into. I like Jake Tapper, but I'm not really sure that's it. No one subscribes to cable. And if they had wrapped this into HBO Max, I would almost certainly, because these are owned by the same company, I would almost certainly tune in occasionally. So yeah. There is something here. So critique, and then what do you think they should do to make the digital future when no one in this audience that we have subscribes to cable? What should people do?
First of all, the HBO thing is going to happen no matter what. I found it hilarious. CNN bought a block of programmatic advertising in order to promote the show. And because at Breaking Points, we don't select or review any of the ads, we basically farm it out to another company so that we don't have any editorial say or whatever in terms of that, except for things that we can block. CNN actually bought ads on the Breaking Points podcast. So that just shows you how it's going over there. And also a big critique of programmatic advertising in general and why it's not necessarily the best tool, which I'm speaking against my own interests here. What's funny to me about it is just how awful the programming is. I mean, the launch programming did not have anything which was going to want to make me actually subscribe. So I just pulled it up here. And
Sagar, could you actually explain that? Because it's actually very key. Explain the difference between CNN normal and CNN Plus, because I'm getting at the issue.
CNN is live news programming, which they have deals with the cable carriers like Cox Communications and Comcast and all those people for decades. They're not going to get out of that. Their live news, their core value product is the only thing that they're allowed to actually host on those programs, and they can't have it anywhere else. This is why live news doesn't exist on YouTube. This is why live sports doesn't exist on YouTube. And it's why these very, very lucrative things that people still want to watch. It's the only thing keeping the cable industry afloat right now. So I go and I look and I'm like, okay, is there anything like that? It's not even about me. I actually have a pretty good hat of being able to recognize stuff that people will watch, not necessarily that I will watch. So here's what we have on the front page. Parental guidance with Anderson Cooper. Have I ever asked for that? Literally ever?
Who has a child is not asking for that.
Do parents really want parenting advice from a single dad about working who is the heir to the Vanderbilt
Is he a single dad?
Yeah, he's a single dad. I don't know what happened with his partner or whatever, but he's a single dad. So he's like talking about being a working father. Like, I'm sorry, you're not have any relatable experience
Here's what you do when your Hamptons home is, you know, like,
it's like, dude, you're literally worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, I'm not saying you don't work hard. You certainly do. And great. It's great that you have a kid.
I think we like Anderson Cooper.
Me too. But I like him in Tahrir Square. I don't need his parenting guidance. So what's happening? Number two, The Source with Casey Hunt. Okay. Look, Casey, she was fine at 5 a.m. on MSNBC. She cut her teeth as a Capitol Hill news reporter. Guess what you're not allowed to do? Interview live congressmen on CNN Plus. And even if you do, nobody's going to see it. So the only thing that you're actually good at and add value to, you just lost it because you put it behind a paywall. You're not actually entertaining to watch. No offense, Casey. It's just simply true. I'm telling you the truth. Second, the newscast with Wolf Blitzer. Once again, I can watch Wolf for free on cable or for a moderate price for 1 to 2 hours a day on CNN, the Situation Room. So why do I need the newscast with Wolf Blitzer? What's going to happen here is they only have access to the same pool of guests, right? Because they're establishment. So they're going to put their A-list guests on Situation Room because that's what the thing actually people watch. And then their D-list guests on the newscast. So, okay, let's keep going on this one. Chris Wallace from The Desk. Okay, so Chris Wallace interviewed Dolly Parton, who apparently had to do 2 CNN Plus appearances because she also appeared on Jake Tapper's thing.
Never seen Dolly Parton anywhere before.
Yeah, never seen her before. Shocking. And then also his latest interview is Admiral Bill McRaven. Like, I'm sorry. Why should anybody pay to watch that? Bill McRaven is a fine guest. He wrote the whole book about discipline. He was the guy in the Osama bin Laden raid. Impressive individual. I think he's the president of the University of Texas. Fine. Okay. The guy, at best, if he belongs on TV, it's during a spot on MSNBC with Morning Joe. Other than that, you really need to watch Chris Wallace sit down with him. Like, really what I'm coming down to is there is no compelling reason in order to subscribe to this product, period. They have shitty, you know, reliable sources every day. Reliable sources is one of the least rated shows on all of CNN. Brian Stelter's ratings go up whenever he's off on vacation. That's how insane things are. In terms of the interview club with Dana Bash, I like Dana. I've watched her for 20 years, probably. Once again, great live TV interviewer. I've watched her do the stuff, you know, the debates. I've seen her on Capitol Hill. She's really short and she's always like thrusting mics into people's faces. That's great. That's for live. That's not on. It's like they just don't understand that they're really good at one thing, but you should stick to that one thing. And if CNN were to have a future online, it would be possibly taking the greatest gamble of the century and giving up the billions of dollars in the billions and billions of dollars in cable contracts and saying, we're going to put live news out for free and we'll figure it out. That would be crazy. And that's the only thing that people would actually pay for.
This is a fascinating example of the innovator's dilemma. So this is like a business school idea of Clayton Christensen, where like the idea is, for example, like Kodak. Kodak is, Kodak is cameras, but they're out of business because they came up with digital cameras in the 1980s. Which is what ended up disrupting their industry, but they didn't go forward with it early because they're like, wait, we make so much money,
tons of money on
doing disposable normal cameras. So that's the innovator's dilemma, which is in order to win, you have to disrupt your existing business line. So to your point, Sagar, no business executive for 15 reasons is going to be able to say, look, guys, let's be real. Actually, because it's funny. People ask, like, why do you guys like, what's good about CNN? This is good. People get mad when Breaking Points uses CNN clips, like CNN video, or I interview someone from the Wall Street Journal. I'm like, no, guys, you have to understand, like, the thing that these mainstream media publications are fundamentally good at is, hey, we pay Chris Mims to write 3 articles a month on supply chains. Yeah. So yeah, dude, I'm going to interview gets Chris paid Mims.
Like $200,000. Like,
exactly.
I don't want to speak for him, but like, that's a lot of money. All right.
And that's the motto. And for CNN, they send a person to Kabul and they send people to Ukraine. And once again, people get killed there. So like, this is a real thing. So there's just no word where someone says, look guys, the only valuable thing we do is that young people actually do want to watch that. If you told me that CNN Plus was that daily Ukraine coverage, because I don't subscribe to cable, I would pay $6.99 a month for that. If that is what that was, I'm not saying I would, but you could convince me to do it. You could not convince me to do anything part of that. They are just not going to give up the cable bundle that really makes that.
Yeah, because it's literally billions of dollars. That's the thing, which is that they are not able to give that up. That's just the end of it. That's the biggest problem they have. And, you know, even now I'm looking, you know, they've got a team of like 25 guys in a conference room on this stuff. They're spending millions of dollars on associate producers and all that. I'm sorry, you guys, you just can't do it. It's not possible in order to compete in this game. They're throwing away their subscriptions at $2.99 a month lifetime in order to juice their initial signup numbers, $59.99 a year. I just see it's already a desperate business, already apparent per their new CEO. They cut the budget in half in terms of what Jeff Zucker wanted to do. Here's what's going to happen. This shit's going to get folded into HBO Max. And that's
which I love. I love HBO Max.
Yeah, HBO Max is great. For example, on their thing, they're like, watch Anthony Bourdain. You know where you can watch Anthony Bourdain? Parts Unknown on HBO Max because they own it. You know, so it's like, why would I pay for this? The only cool thing, the only one that I could see on there is Scott Galloway's show. But here's the other problem. I get Scott for free already. So why should I watch it? I get Scott for free on the Prof G show and on Pivot, his flagship product. No offense to Scott,
on the show. Let's get like, and look, Scott,
we real here. You're gonna put your A-list like, stuff behind a paywall. I don't believe you. Yeah, like,
yeah, no, it's just not like Jason Calacanis had a good tweet. Jason Calacanis had a great tweet about CNN Plus. He said he beefs with Scott, but he was like, Scott is not as good here as he is with Kara.
Yeah.
So there's just like, that is just the underlying reality here. Dude, this has been great. So yeah, everyone, this is the first of our every 2 weeks, like discussion episodes that like better accommodate the fact that one host lives in a Zoom room. The other host actually has to drive places. So this is really great. So like, let us know your comments, let us know your questions, send a tip in. That's always fun. And look forward to doing this again soon.
Cool. All right. I'll talk to you guys later. See you.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.